Star Trek 57, M23, take two.
Star Trek Podcast.
Forgive me. It is not here. I had assumed he mind-melded with you. It is the Vulcan way. When the body's end is near.
We were separate.
He couldn't touch me. I see. And everything that he was, everything he knew, is lost.
Please wait. He would have found a way if there was that much at stake. Spock would have found a way.
Yes. But how?
I'm ready to start whenever you guys are. We can start the podcast proper.
Oh, the actual podcast?
The actual podcast.
Let's actually start the podcast.
Hold on.
Unable to comply.
Starting the podcast.
Starting.
Destruct sequence completed and engaged.
See, Dan's got the real sound effects.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
I just have
court is now in session.
He's got
that's my favorite
concurrent sound effects. He's got sound effects from last week, and perhaps he'll surprise us with some sound effects from episodes of yore going way back when. All right, let's get
damn right.
Yes, I am. You're goddamn right. I'm damn right.
Yeah.
Okay. So all right.
This is Scott Star Trek podcast.
Okay. Thank you, Dan. Dan's being very helpful this evening.
Episode number.
This is episode 190.
190
of the It's Got Star Trek podcast.
150.
So we thought, what better time than episode 190 to discuss another Star Trek movie, because we've only previously done Star Trek VI.
Yeah.
A long time ago. I don't remember which episode.
Is that one of our most downloaded?
It is also one of our most downloaded. I haven't listened to it in a long time, so I can't personally vouch for the quality, but hey, it's probably
pretty
good.
I remember it was all right.
It was probably pretty good. But this week, on episode 190 of the
Star Trek
podcast.
That was back when we were really trying.
Yeah. Too right. We will be discussing, yes, Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. Mm-hmm. And Spork. What else do we have to mention? It's episode 190. Oh, yeah, we are coming up on our 200th episode. So we would like to solicit some emails or audio.
Help me.
Audio recordings, message machine, whatevers. We'll try to see if we can set something up on the web and let you know in the coming weeks if we can have some easy way to send that in. But otherwise, you can email us at feedback@itsgotstartrek.com with any of your thoughts, in celebratory thoughts for the It's Got Star Trek podcast 200th episode, and we'll put it all together in a big extravaganza, do some fun
stuff. What must I do?
Oh, an extravaganza.
We'll do some sort of extravaganza. We got to. It's 200
extravaganza.
Episodes. You got to do some sort of extravaganza.
This is impossible.
And a 200 episode 200 gives us an opportunity to change our flavors a bit, tweak things, some things, come up with some new ideas, shake them some things about. That will start with a celebration. So we would welcome your thoughts and feedback on what 200 episodes of It's Got Star Trek have meant for you.
Get them now.
Right. It's gonna be a special one.
I think it'll be a good one.
Very special. Very special episode.
Yes, quite special indeed. Okay, so with that being said, we can jump right into our very earnest discussion mm-hmm. of this movie that I think is often overlooked by fans. It's the middle section. Some people argue.
It's like a trilogy kind of a
some
thing,
people,
right?
Yeah. So, and I'm going to make, I want you guys to let me know what you think about this thought.
Okay.
About my position.
Lay it on us.
As you were hinting at, as you were alluding to, Jesse, it is commonly perceived that Star Trek's 2, 3, and 4 are a trilogy. Maybe not a purposeful trilogy, but they function as a trilogy.
They're all related in the story. Yeah.
And it's sort of one continuous story arc. And I am fine with that. I think there's a good argument for that. However, I personally, growing up watching these movies, I kind of felt that Star Trek 2 and 3 were more of a duology, with Star Trek 4 being the bonus extra fun time play, you know, just extending it a little bit more.
It's a goofy movie.
Because you have because Star Trek 2 is about the past catching up with Kirk, but then Star Trek 3 is like the way Kirk resolved that no-win situation. Kirk is all about, like, I don't believe in no-win situations. The way he resolves that no-win situation is that happens in Star Trek 3. He thinks he's lost in Star Trek 2, but in Star Trek 3, there's this arc where he has this opportunity to save Spock's soul.
For real.
And to me, that's the arc. That arc sort of ends there.
Katra.
Star Trek 4 is just fun whale touching and you know, all that jazz.
Well, I mean, the Spock, it's also sort Spock. Of like Spock dies, Spock. Right? And then he comes back to life, right? And then I could see they could say 4 is the third because Spock's like begins the movie with Spock sort of learning his shit again. But it kind of ends there in terms of similarity because suddenly Spock's kind of just Spock again.
He's being all goofy and fun.
Yeah, he's all
talking about LDS. No, that's Kirk. He's all talking about double dumbasses. No, that's Kirk.
Double dumbass on you.
But he is being very stoic.
His Katra, his living spirit.
Okay.
It's Katra.
Sometimes I question your placement.
You know what I noticed? Speaking of Star Trek 4, they're wearing the same civilian clothes that they do because they just haven't had a time. Yeah. That's all the clothes they got. They haven't changed out of them. That's all they got.
These all the events that happen in Star Trek 2, 3, and 4 are what in the course of like a month or something.
Yeah,
Well, so, I mean, so yeah, they're.
But some of them have some goofy ass clothes. Sulu's got pretty smooth clothes.
Sulu's always got smooth clothes.
Maybe McCoy is all right if you're like an old dude.
I like Shatner's leather jacket.
I think that's well.
Was it too shiny?
The leather jacket's cool, but like his like sort of silly suit thing, I think is
that I'm not a big fan of. But the leather jacket, I think, is cool.
So Spock, you know, he dies and he comes back to life. He gets rebuilt from the Genesis planet. It goes in spurts and makes you spurt back to life.
Yeah,
and for the planet,
he grew rapidly and painfully.
So the planet like expressed this by getting rocks and volcanoes, like a planet growing planet does. And Spock did the whole Wolfman thing, where his face
Yeah, that was intense.
It's right around in this time period.
Yeah, so
early 80s.
So they grow in spurts. I guess the what's implied is that when Spock leaves the planet, he no longer follows that accelerated growth
reason. Why not? He coincidentally stops aging at the point he was before he died.
Now, did they establish that transporters back in TOS, that how transporters worked? Were they like, yes, it takes away your molecules and puts them back together? Or did they just not talk about
it? It kills you.
Well, yes,
and builds a copy of it.
Right, exactly. Now, did they talk
about that's why McCoy didn't like that.
Well, so was that established?
Philosophically was that upsetting device.
Was that, I'm wondering at what point in TOS that got established, because that's essentially what happens to Spock. I mean, he gets obliterated. His body doesn't get obliterated, but he gets fucked up, and then
like,
and then he gets rebuilt. His shit gets all rebuilt, but that's essentially what happens with the transporter. Obviously, there's something different about it, but I mean,
we don't see exactly what happens. We don't see if his body all decomposes and is just like a slurry of cells, and then one of them regenerates into a little baby cell, or if they all coalesce T-1000 style into baby Spock, and then baby Spock's all figuring out how to eat food or whatever. I guess aged quick enough to sort this out.
He's probably eating them worms.
If you poke the plot too much, it ain't gonna work.
Yeah, what they say is they can resurrect Spock through a molecular recreation from the Genesis device.
Well, so I happen to know the answer. The answer is proto-molecule.
Right, because they use
that's the answer for anything that doesn't make sense in this particular episode,
which is an illegal. Proto-molecules illegal.
Proto-molecule.
It's proto-matter.
Proto-matter. Isn't it? Oh, yeah, it's proto-molecule. What I'm such an idiot for saying proto-molecule, but
isn't that from Expanse?
It's the Expanse is on my mind, but yes. Yeah. Proto-matter.
But it reminded me of the Expanse.
Not proto-molecule. Yeah. Okay, so.
Yes.
Star Trek 3.
Yes.
I think just to lay the foundation for the conversation, I'm curious about when did people see this? How often have you seen this? Where does this fit in your knowledge of the Star Trek lore? Is it something you know well? Is it something that you're very unfamiliar with?
So I remember as a kid having two sort of scenes stuck in my head out of context from everything else. One was like the whole Darth Vader, you know, Luke Skywalker scene in Empire Strikes Back where he's all like, you know, Luke.
Oh, you mean, I thought you meant two scenes from this movie.
Oh, no.
But you mean one scene from Star Wars.
Yeah.
And one scene from this movie.
Yeah, that's what I meant. I should have clarified that. Like, of those childhood memories you have where they've just always been there and you don't know at what point they entered your brain. At least that's, I'm assuming other people have that, but that's inappropriate of me to assume.
Well, Return of the Jedi is a very old movie.
It was Empire Strikes Back.
He was talking about the part where
Empire
Vader's
Strikes
like,
Back. That's even older.
I am your father.
Yeah, that part. So that scene.
I'm your father.
That movie's as old as you is.
So I have a memory of his hand getting cut off and him falling down that pit and being like, whoa, that's fucking crazy.
No!
But I also have a memory of fucking Krug. Krug?
Yes, I believe it was Captain Krug. Krug or Commander Krug.
Him, like, falling into the lava going into the lava so much that I don't even remember it being Christopher Lloyd. I just remember some, like, Klingon was falling. And I kept watching Star Trek 2 being like, where's that scene? Yeah. And then, like, when I got of a certain age, I explored my mind and realized.
When your parents thought you were old enough, they were like, here's Star Trek 3.
Yeah.
Because Star Trek 3 is pretty fucked up compared to Star Trek 2. Star Trek 2 is great. It's a brilliant movie. Star Trek 3 is pretty fucked up. How about you, Jesse?
I think I've really only seen it a few times. I mean, I was aware of the story sort of, and you know what happens during the movie, but I've really only seen it a couple of times, and I never saw it in the theater.
I can't remember the last time I saw this before this past time. It's been a couple decades. It's probably been a couple decades.
Like, I didn't remember like all the parts. I remember like some of the, you know, the main stuff, and you know, the weird bar with McCoy.
Yeah.
And they had a devil guy, just like out of Star Wars, that a devil guy too. Was this the first I was going to say, you're talking about scenes that I forgot the whole like close up of the knife and he presses the button and goes chink. Was that a Duk Tog? A Duk Tog?
Is that a Duk Tog? Is that what that is?
This is a rhetorical question. You clearly have looked this up.
Are you
up.
The Klingon expert?
I was just wondering.
Are you the Klingon
expert? Do you think it's a Duk Tog? I mean, I don't know. I haven't thought about it in a while or
as
anything.
As opposed to what?
As opposed to something, other Klingon weapon.
Like a mechleth?
Mechleth.
Clearly it's not a mechleth.
It's got a mechanism. I like how it's all close up and you see the fingerprints. It's like they were showing off like the prop people's awesome invention. And it was like, here, you press this button here.
It
and
is.
It opens like, but it's an awesome, awesome. It's awesome.
And
awesome
that dude invention. So he decides to fight the Klingon and then he just dies all quickly.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to David's death in a bit. For my part, I hadn't seen the movie in quite some time. However, when I was a kid, I had purchased, or my parents had purchased for me, the five movie VHS set box that the first five movies came in, and they all had the when you put them all in the right order, it showed all the pictures lined up to be a front facing picture of the Enterprise. And then Star Trek VI came out, and then that kind of went outside of the box, but it still sort of fit in there.
Outside the box.
But when I was a kid, I watched the fuck out of Star Trek 3. Mm. It wasn't my favorite necessarily, but it was very, it intrigued me. I think it was so different. And watching it again, I was reminded about how different it was. And you talk about core memories, Dan. Mm-hmm. I definitely have like a few from this movie. And one of them is that bar, right, where McCoy meets the sort of proto-Ferengi guy.
Oh, he is kind of like a proto-Ferengi.
With his ears. He's like, with ears talking. Like that. And he's all like,
to your planet, welcome.
Yes, that line, to your planet, welcome. I use that in daily conversation. And this is not something I've forgotten. I know exactly where it's from. But that whole exchange, really fascinated me that this
planet forbidden.
the CD bar. I think my opinion of security services, my paranoia and nervousness around like security people is partly from this movie because unlike a lot of Star Trek, the security is fairly competent in this in this movie. They're actually doing stuff. Mm-hmm. Like we live in the DC area, and so there's always the assumption that there's these handlers lurking at any moment just waiting for somebody to say the wrong thing and come up and gently say like, all right, I think we need to give you a ride home. So that was a core memory.
Wait, there was one more thing that Devil Guy said.
Place you name, money I name, otherwise bargain.
No.
But this
bargain, no.
The first one.
A lot
your
of
your planet. Welcome.
That sounds Ferengi, kind of like, well, not the order of words, but like the way.
It's like Yoda mixed with Ferengi.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I had to see it to believe it.
Yoda Rengi.
But I really appreciate this movie. Part of it is nostalgia, but part of it is that it goes to some interesting places. Some of that I think is clearly influenced by Leonard Nimoy, who directed the movie.
That's right.
It's very interesting to watch a movie where Spock is almost entirely absent for the vast majority of the movie, but he infuses the entire thing. It's all Spock all the time.
Right.
But you watch this and you're reminded how many sort of famous things from Star Trek, the stealing of the Enterprise and, you know, all this stuff that we'll go through, the death of David, that you Klingon bastard, you killed my son. All these things happen in this movie that are important to the overall, Star Trek VI doesn't happen without the events in
the destruction
in
of the Enterprise.
So I think it's a wonderful movie. I hope people who are listening to this episode presumably watched the movie. I hope if you hadn't seen it before, I hope you enjoyed it and found it to be some sort of a slightly different thing than you normally get in Star Trek. I do think that's partly why it often was not seen as quite as engaging or successful. I think it put a few people off, and it's not as fun as something like Star Trek IV.
In the middle of the movie, there's a part where McCoy is talking, and he sounds just like Spock.
They do that a few times.
And so this one...
Scanning. Indications negative at this time.
Yeah. That's supposed to be McCoy, but that must be...
It's Leonard Nimoy.
It must actually be Leonard Nimoy.
Yes. Nimoy.
So... you notice I paused after I said Nimoy because I was waiting for someone to say something.
He said it too.
Yeah, I know. He stole my thunder.
Dan is aggravated because I predicted that he was going to say Nimoy, and so I said Nimoy, which may be the correct pronunciation. I don't know. It may be.
So, but this
maybe
was
Newt.
In the bar. This was a McCoy line that was
McCoy, Dr. McCoy.
Let's pause for some more low hanging laughter here.
Unable to comply.
Okay, so this is McCoy talking, and McCoy's lines mixed with some spoke.
Where's the logic in offering me a ride home, you idiot?
Yeah.
Now that's classic. See, they did the whole Spock.
Right.
And he's yelling it, and then he ends it with you idiot. Well, so it's like they did the whole blending McCoy and Spock that was pretty neat.
I agree. I think it's like super neat. This is not a flawless movie, and we can go into that at some point, what some of the little quirks about it are. But overall, I think the writing is really good. I think the characterization is really good. It's another example of sort of late in a segment of the franchise. You know, this is TOS. Yes, they would go on to do a few more movies, but they're in Star Trek II and Star Trek III, they've got it down, you know?
They're both movies are focused on a singular event.
Yes, hyper-focused, and the characters are driving things, and right. The actors know how to... The actors and the writers are all firing on all cylinders in terms of, like, what the characters are at this stage in their
there's
lives.
There's really no stepping back and doing some kind of, like lawyer speak, lawyer movie, lawyer dialogue, lawyer something, you know, when you say lawyer, because like lawyer ball, it's not, you're actually not playing.
I mean I'm familiar with the concept that you're describing. I'm not yet 100% sure what you're talking about with in the context of this movie.
They don't, you know, sometimes movies, they try to step back and create this big robust sort of
I know it now. Yeah,
grand skiing, a grand
poobah, the grand poobah,
grand poobah, you know,
from
the words, the grand
words.
Not scheme. What's the meta? Wrong with me?
I think we get the idea, though, that because I was going to make a similar point about
there's no people back in the office going blah 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 blah. We've got a blah 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 blah, which is like all of like Phantom Menace was pretty much all.
I think I'm 100% feeling what you're talking about.
Picking up what I'm putting down.
I'm picking up what you're putting down, buddy. It's a tight story.
It's tight.
It's a heist story. It's got religion. It's got politics. Yes. It's got geopolitics.
Yes.
It's got interpersonal drama.
Yes.
It's got death.
Yes.
It's got love.
Yes.
Not really. But I mean, we'll get to that too. There's a little love in there.
No!
A little suspicious of. But I guess all of this is to say, I think there's so much going for this movie, even though it's not perfect and maybe feels a little weird in some spots.
They talk at one point about, this is related to this movie, about how much they know about Klingons at this point in the movie. Mm. They're not too aware of cloaking devices as they work in this movie. They're like, they figure out, they're like, oh, we can't, you know, they can't shoot while they're cloaked or something. They make all these like sort of hypotheses.
There's a meta reason for this, the behind the scenes stuff, which is that in the original conception of this storyline, it was still Commander Krug or Captain Krug, whichever, I forget what his rank is.
I think he was Commander.
So Commander Krug and his sort of renegade group of Klingons. So that was the same, except in the initial part of the movie, Commander Krug would have stolen a Romulan bird of prey, because in the context of Star Trek, the original series, Klingons didn't have birds of prey. Romulans had birds of prey, and Romulans developed a cloaking device.
Right.
So in the original treatment for this movie, Commander Krug was going to capture a Romulan bird of prey for the purpose of getting to the Genesis planet, right?
Because
he has this whole scheme, and part of the scheme was getting a Romulan bird of prey. Mm-hmm. Now, the cloaking, the bird of prey, all of that stayed in the plot of the movie, but they got rid of the thing where he steals it, and instead it just is like a Klingon ship.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
So he just steals the bird of prey.
Well, it's hit. No, in the final movie, you're presuming it's his bird of prey, but he's gone rogue.
Right, right, okay.
Like a Navy captain going rogue and doing whatever.
So how's this behind the scenes?
The behind the scenes was.
Oh, I must have been too busy finding a little. Yeah.
It was the script was different. The script originally was that he stole a Romulan ship, and that fell out of the script.
Okay.
By the time they were shooting the movie, all the plot points still remained. It's just that he didn't steal a different ship.
So they know all about the Klingons, I guess, at this point.
They know all about the Klingons.
I mean, I know that the Klingons were in TOS, but it's like sometimes they don't go into sort of lore about...
But we do learn a lot about Klingon lore in this particular episode, and I propose this.
Episode? You mean movie.
Yes, I do mean movie. I'm stupid.
An easy mistake.
I'm really, really stupid.
Oh, you joke!
Okay. I propose we take a brief break, and when we get back...
A brief break.
When we get back, we talk a little bit about what this movie introduces to the Klingon lore.
Shoot in there!
All right, we will be right back. All right, we're back. We're back with It's Got Star Trek.
You're dead!
Talking Star Trek 3.
Come on, pull!
The switch for Spock.
Doesn't this sound like Discovery sounds like they lift when Discovery first had Klingons. They sounded like they lifted from
Star Trek 3.
Star Trek 3, like this line.
Come on, pull.
That sounds like they something they
put on pull.
Yeah,
put on pull.
Yeah, you have that. You have a clip of you somewhere where you're talking a bunch of Discovery Klingonese.
I can't even do it anymore.
Doc Bay.
Doc Bay.
Put on tour.
Pull on pull.
Andorian tour.
Wow, I can't do it anymore.
No, you can't.
That's really something. Yeah.
You were just saying,
come on, pull.
No, I was
you lost it.
I lost it.
I recommend listeners go way back.
Oh, it's way
scroll way back in the feed to when we covered the Discovery
pilots.
What's a pilot?
I think that's episode 6 or 7 maybe.
Hell of a time to ask.
6, 7. And you can listen to Dan doing some truly quite sincerely, brilliant Klingonese.
Gotcha.
in this Star Trek Discovery style. Yeah, she knows what's up. Okay. Klingons. Star Trek 3 adds a whole bunch to the Klingon lore. We just noted that they introduced this idea of the Klingon bird of prey, which becomes one of the most commonly used and most awesome Klingon ships throughout the rest of Star Trek, including Star Trek VI in particular. Star Trek IV, of course. This exact Klingon ship shows up later in Picard.
Totally, it does.
So we've got the Klingon bird of prey. We've got the Targ. I think this is the first.
It is a Targ.
That's totally a Targ.
They don't call it a Targ, but it's got to be Toby a Targ.
It's got that like shiny, slimy look, kind of like those Ghostbuster dogs. Yeah. Those I always call them terror dogs, I don't know what they're actually called. But they kind of look like that. Sort of demon dogs.
I like this Targ better than some of the later Targs that were just friendly dogs.
This looks more like a big, weird, goopy rat thing.
Like a monster. It looked like a Klingon pet monster.
Yeah, it did. Totally, I liked it, too.
It didn't look like a German shepherd with some spikes glued onto its head.
And I don't know if it was when it was getting zapped or when the ship was just kind of blowing up, like the crew's going, and the Targ's just kind of, it looks like someone's just kind of shaking it upside down. It's going
and it's all like,
but it made me feel bad for it. I was like,
when it died? The timing isn't exactly right, but the Targ looked very similar in some ways to an ROUS.
A rodent of unusual size
from Princess Bride.
As you wish.
Inconceivable.
Especially when you just, as you described, Dan, when it sort of inexplicably dies because it's not like everyone else dies on the bridge. It's like something, it gets zapped or something and it falls over and it's all like,
because you wish it.
That was the closest I had to As You Wish from Princess Bride.
It works.
Yeah.
It's synonymous. It's functionally the same, if perhaps lacking in some of the emotional pithiness.
Be careful what you wish for.
I will. I am always careful what I wish for, because I've read too many
monkey paw stories. You mean monkeys paw stories? Ha 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 ha.
No, you're right. It's important that we clarify that to the audience.
Do you remember that scene in UHF when like they're all laughing at the office because the bad guy finds like the file he fired Stanley Spadowski over and he's like, he was here all along.
Yeah.
And then when his son's all like, you remember that from UHF?
I do. Yeah.
That's
it. I mean, that's spot on. It's spot on.
That's how my daughter laughs.
All right, more Klingon stuff. Okay, so you've got Bird of Prey. You got Targ. You've got the uniforms.
Got your Targ.
You've got some of the
Klingon faces.
Some of the Klingon face action. You have Klingon brutality, but also not like willy-nilly brutality. I think it's really there's that great scene where Commander Krug asks the gunner guy to shoot the USS Grissom's engines, and he blows up the whole fucking ship.
Yeah, right.
And the guy's all like, it was a lucky shot. And right. Then he just blows the guy away in the most painful-looking disruptor death ever.
By the way, one thing I like about Star Trek, it seems like every time somebody like melts from a phaser or a disruptor or whatever, it's different every time.
Yeah,
you never know what
different.
You're going to get. It's kind of awesome.
That's true.
Like, even in
movie. Which makes those weapons even more terrifying because you're like,
settings,
I don't know which one I'm going to get. Is it like dependent on the humidity? What is governing how slowly? Because this guy was straight up like,
he melted away.
That's unlike though Kirk. I think it was Kirk who shot one of the Klingons at the end, and he like flew up in the
air.
I
think that was more on like a stun button, but he
that
still
was
seemed
like
to
the
end
flyback
up dead.
How do you get the flyback setting? Because you
the flyback setting,
you fly backwards.
Because the whole the laws of like, you know, equal and opposite. Every action
you're
is
saying
equal
that the
opposite,
light reaction. That light should not be able to impart that much momentum.
No, I'm not. I'm saying that if the light did impart that much momentum, it would impart the same momentum towards the firer. So if something hit them and they went 10 feet back, the person firing it would also go 10 feet back. But I'm assuming it's Star Trek phasers and they do some, like, they gather mass or something crazy.
While that assumption is fine, I think the observation is incredibly astute.
Thanks.
Because that's a good point. Opposite and equal reactions.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some sort of kick suppressor or something.
I mean, you can mind cannon it pretty easily on that.
Mind cannon.
Mind cannon.
I mean,
this is cannon in the mind.
I like the term mind cannon. I think more commonly you hear head cannon.
I like mind cannon.
Mind cannon seems a little less because
mind blaster.
Head cannon makes me think of pointing a cannon at my head, having a cannon coming out of my head.
Well, mind cannon makes a cannon coming out of your mind, which is even crazier.
Because I'm going to blast you with my mind.
Why did you do that?
Right.
We get to see so we've got Krug.
Yes,
who we find out through the course of the movie is a renegade Klingon, and his crew is following him because basically it's the analogy to a rogue military commander who's decided for the good of the country or whatever. But secretly it's really for his own good, but that he disagrees with his government. So he's going to take some troops and go do some shady shit.
So it's interesting the point you brought up about who he says he's doing it for, because what they say in the movie, he says he's doing it for the glory of the race.
Yes.
Of the Klingon race.
Protect their race.
But you notice later, they're always in TNG and especially DS9, they're always talking about the glory of the Empire. I'm wondering if they sort of changed it from, if they did that on purpose, or if there was any kind of like subconscious reason to change it from glory of the race to glory of the Empire, or maybe Krug's just an asshole and he talked and like
I think it's a nuanced difference, but I think it's a purposeful difference. Maybe that's the influence of Leonard
Nimoy
as opposed to Leonard McCoy, the story and directing this movie, because there are a lot of those little choices. Like, for example,
the question is, is that Krug saying for the glory of the race? Is that a common thing Klingon said back then, or does his true Klingon say glory of the Empire, or does it even fucking matter? I don't know.
It could be that they conflate the two.
They say it in Klingon, though,
I could see
he says it in English for some reason. They randomly switch back and forth between Klingon and English. They don't do it just Klingon.
And they don't do the clever Hunt for Red October thing.
No. Oh, where they zoom in.
Where they do the whole like, they're actually talking Russian the whole time.
Why?
But a couple other examples in this movie, not directly related to the Klingons, but there are a lot of biblical references, not just Genesis, which is a holdover from Star Trek II, but there are a number of lines like where David refers to being the little creatures being fruitful and multiplying.
Are you talking about the little the shrimpy flaps?
Yeah, and then going to the promised land, there's references to the promised land. So there's a lot of biblical imagery.
Like those shrimpy flaps from those little tiny things.
On the outside of the tube.
And they grew and they grew and they became big. And then Krug.
Then they turned into tubey flaps.
By the time Krug ran into them, they were monsters.
Do you notice that thing was choking him and his dudes weren't helping him? Do you think that was on purpose? Do you think he was like,
it was a gag.
Well, I mean, Klingons would call that like an honorable battle.
No, it was a movie gag, because the whole gag is that he encounters that creature, it strangles him, he squeezes it until like he crushes it with his hands and blood comes out, he throws it on the ground, then he reports back to the bridge, says, nothing's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a joke.
Well, the joke...
I thought it was a very funny joke.
Wait, so the fact that his crew doesn't help him out, that's part of the joke. That's what I'm saying is why didn't his crew help him out?
Because happening here. It's a characterization of the Klingons. It's a joke that also characterizes the Klingons of what do they consider, what do they perceive as being...
a threat.
Not even a threat. What do they perceive as being a relevant thing to report on the log? And being attacked by a mutant monster worm creature and potentially nearly dying from it until you just crush it to death and the blood is, your fingers are just squeezing into the sinews of this creature, it's not even worth reporting. It's such an insignificant thing.
I was thinking something along this, like the same philosophy, just a totally different direction. I was just thinking like his crew didn't help him because they were like, he would want to fight it off himself to prove he's a badass.
Klingons might not have the same sort of like, oh wait, I got to help somebody instinct that a human does.
It's like, that's insulting. It's insulting.
They're going to see what this guy does with the monster, and then they're going to see who's going to be captain afterwards.
But I think Patrick's gag is legit, though.
Yeah.
Verified.
What was that?
Verified.
Why?
Other Klingon stuff. So yeah, he's a renegade Klingon. He's got his crew behind him. He's also got this Klingon lover, Valkris, I believe is her name.
Yeah, Valkris.
She's the one who is helping broker the deal to get the stolen data, which is another thing I love. I love the idea of some shady little merchants getting their hands on official Starfleet logs, like military logs.
Those guys were shady looking.
And then selling them.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, selling them on the open market. And that was just I love CD Underworld stuff. And we see so much CD Underworld in Star Trek 3. And we learn more about this Klingon honor stuff, which has been evolving. From the show, there wasn't much Klingon honor. It was more like Klingons are just pieces of shit. Now we're starting to see the first hints of there's a code.
That's why his crew didn't help him with that, with the Tubi flap, because it was for his honor.
Perhaps. And then
or maybe it was just a gag.
Porque no los Chable
sous la berge.
Yes, it could be both.
Porque no los both.
But I said dos. But Valkris, where we see this Klingon honor stuff going on, that we see much more developed later on TNG and DS9 in particular, is when Valkris is all like, okay, here, I got the tape. You're going to love it. And Krug is all like, oh, shit, you watched it? And she's like, well, yeah, I had to like make sure it was real. And he was like, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. And she's like, all right, I got it.
Yeah.
And then he fucking murders her.
Yeah.
And he seems like really put out that he has to murder her, but he does it anyway. And she seems like put out that she's not going to get to hang out with Krug anymore. But she's also seems all like, she seems like she feels awesome for about to be getting blown up.
Yeah, it seems like
fucking with those merchants.
It seems like kind of like a bad day at the office kind of deal, you know. But that's, it must be stressful for a Klingon though to like live life making sure that you die like in battle all the time. It's like must be kind of a relief when it finally happens. You're like, God, thank God I didn't fall down the stairs or some shit. You know,
I didn't get sick and shit.
Or didn't get a bunch of barrels fall on me.
Yeah, right. Big weird barrels.
Yeah, those Worf crushing
BWBs. Classic case of BWBs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Big weird barrels.
Yeah.
Hexagonal barrels.
Hexagonal.
Any other Klingon stuff that we learn? I don't know. I think there's probably like those are some of the main things. However, I also think what's nice is
The bird of prey complement is about a dozen officers and men.
It's a That's scout a ship. They referred to as sort of a scout class ship. Even if it has a lot of good weapons on it, it's not a match for a heavy cruiser like
it's not
Enterprise.
Real big,
not like a frigate.
They just totally landed that shit on Vulcan.
Like, yeah, they did.
Klingons are they're surprised to learn that the Enterprise is run by a computer.
Yeah,
that is new to them.
No internet, no computers,
nothing.
The only thing talking is the computer. But what I was going to say is that the other thing we learn about Klingons, maybe not learn about them, but that they accentuate here, is that each of these main Klingon characters that we interact with has very different personalities. They carry themselves differently. They have different attitudes towards things. Krug has his own thing going on. John Larroquette Klingon. I don't know if he ever gets a name. I just call him John Larroquette
Isn't that like
Klingon.
Something with an M?
Maybe.
How can you tell that?
I don't think that was the John Larroquette.
No, it was that. But and then there's
but
the
that
other,
was one of the Klingon.
Then
crew.
There's the other guy who is the one who dies when the Enterprise blows up, and we'll get to the.
Is it this guy?
Movie. How can you tell that?
Sounds totally not like a Klingon.
Yeah, I think he might be. But that's the thing that's cool about it is that what we get here, and then we start getting on TNG, we get in Star Trek VI, especially both this movie and Star Trek VI do a great job of having Klingons that fit the overall meta Klingon mold, but are individuals clearly identifiable, and not just from their costuming, but from their personalities and the choices that they make. And that includes Valkris, even though we only see her for a little bit, Krug, and these other fellows, even some of the lower level extra types on the planet, they got their own thing going on too.
Well, I wasn't sure their view. For a second, I thought they were a little more sexist back in this version of Star Trek, because there was the line where Krug sees them on the planet and he's like, I've come a long way for the power of Genesis. And what do I find? A weakling human, a Vulcan boy, and a woman. Yeah. But then like...
A Vulcan woman.
But then like, he says, and a woman. He says a Vulcan boy and... You think it was implied that as a Vulcan boy and a Vulcan woman?
I kind of thought so.
I'm only interpreting it that way because that's how I've interpreted it since I was a child.
Well, it makes more sense because Valkris is like on... She's like...
Vulcan boy and a woman.
And what was confusing me is because Valkris is like in command of this ship. So it's not like... it's not like women are looked down upon, like
and traditionally
in Klingon culture.
And traditionally,
and
they weren't,
and I traditionally think. They weren't. So that's why I was confused. But now that's a that's pedantry, right? Yeah. That's pedantic. Is a Vulcan boy and a Vulcan woman?
Not necessarily pedantic.
Semantic. It's, that's the word. I was confused. I was confused by semantics.
I think
because I thought he just said a Vulcan boy separately, a woman of any kind. But you're saying it's a Vulcan boy and a Vulcan woman, and that's what I misunderstood.
He's my good time boy. I think
my good time boy.
I think
relating to meaning in language or logic, semantic.
Yeah, I don't.
I was saying it's my fault.
I think no, I'm defending you here, Dan.
I'm defending nobody.
I think no fault need be assigned in this particular situation. I think that your observation is is totally valid. Whether it's the right interpretation or not is up to the individual user of this movie.
The user
of this movie will interpret that line in different, and I think it's nebulous enough that it could be seen either way. You could either be like a weakling human, a Vulcan boy, and a woman. Or it could be like a Vulcan boy and a woman.
Mm-hmm.
It's awkward.
It's awkward.
It's not 100% clear.
Why?
They could have taken a few extra passes.
But why?
at this one.
Yes.
All right. What's next on the docket? If we've covered all the Klingon stuff, unless there's a couple,
Do we want to jump straight to Krug? Or
I guess since we've been talking about Klingons, might as well wrap it up with the Krug business. Christopher Lloyd,
Krug.
I think, does a great job.
Right.
It was going to be difficult to follow up Ricardo Montalban's Khan and crew in Star Trek II for all the reasons that are obvious to, I think, our whole audience. That being said, while I understand Star Trek III may have suffered a little bit in the contemporaneous perception because of that, I think Christopher Lloyd was terrifying. I thought he was a scary fucking villain.
He was.
Because he's charming. He's smart. He's not like, kill them all. He's like, no, I want some fucking hostages. I've got a strategy. I've got like things planned out to get at what I want to get at. And then his whole being so callous about just kill one of the hostages.
Yeah,
Khan never did that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you rarely see that on Star Trek, and you never see it where then one of the hostages dies, right?
Right.
Usually they're rescued at the last minute.
Well, there was one line. There was a couple lines where he popped out, and I was like, "That's definitely Christopher Lloyd." Yeah. And it was good in his good way. So here's one of them.
Admiral, your young friend is mistaken. I meant what I said.
That sounds like that's a Lloyd delivery.
Yes, it's very Lloyd.
And here's another one.
It'll shoot the fleas off a dog's back at 500 yards, cannon, and it's pointed straight at your head.
Yes. Yeah. No. You know. You're right. That's it comes very,
very Christopher Lloyd.
Lloyd. You know. He's just all over this movie.
Yeah. And then the last is this.
Drop all weapons.
And that was just. It was.
Drop all weapons.
Yeah, all like very that. Three very.
Drop all weapons.
Yeah.
88
miles
per
hour.
Drop all weapons. Drop all.
1.21 gigawatts.
1.21 gigawatts.
Marty.
Tom. What was I thinking? Marty, you made it.
Is it? What are they? They become a bunch of assholes or something? No, it's like, I forget. It's like,
Marty, you gotta come back. Gotta come back with me to the future. What, do we become assholes or something?
Yeah.
No, it's your kids, Marty. Something's gotta be done about your kids. Yes. I was impressed with Lloyd not only for portraying this character in a pretty threatening way. I mean, a no holds barred, clever opponent who nearly gets the best of Kirk and in legitimate style, right? You know, that's the thing is it's not like some MacGuffin pops up. It was like actual, like really good strategy that he was using against Kirk and co. I also, though, am impressed with his use of Klingon, right? He does talk a lot of Klingon in this movie, and I think when he's talking Klingon is when he's the least Lloydish. Which makes perfect sense. But it sounds Klingon.
Come on, poo!
Yes, it does. But all props to Christopher Lloyd. Also, all props to John Larroquette. A small part. This is, I believe, before Night Court started. I'm not familiar enough with John Larroquette's career prior to Night Court. Many of our audience won't know what the fuck a Night Court is, both because the television show is old, though it's been rebooted, and also, like, probably most sensible jurisdictions don't have so many court cases and don't live in such a police state that a night court is required to accommodate.
But that's when all the crazies come out.
I know. It's you got to have somebody to arraign people in certain times at night or whatever. Maybe it's better to have a night court just to throw people in jail.
Whatever. Is this better?
Jolampu!
It's pretty good.
It's not quite there yet.
It's pretty good.
Jewel! I have to be more.
Jewel?
I have to strain my throat more. Anyone who sings would probably hate to hear that.
I don't know, because I don't remember you anyone straining your throat so
I think much. I think maybe I need to come more from the diaphragm.
How about this? Before we go to break, can you cycle quickly through some of your characters?
Some of my characters.
It might get you reoriented into the Tulum Poo.
Put me on the spot.
The Andorian Poo. Umantu.
Hey Willie! Hey Willie! Hey. You got any cat?
That's a good one.
Yeah.
How about the Alf, of course. Right. How about the where's
excuse
that?
Excuse me.
Yeah, the excuse me lady.
Excuse me. Yes. You're standing in the doorway.
Yeah.
There's that one.
That's a deep cut.
Yeah, that's a deep cut.
That's one of those deep cuts that even if you hear the original, it doesn't fully make any
voice.
Sense.
He's got the wine voice.
The wine voice.
Hey, Jesse, yeah, what are you doing? We're talking with the wine voice.
That's my favorite voice.
Oh, didn't use the wine voice Christopher Lloyd was being nibbled on by the wimes.
I know.
Commander Coob.
Is this what the kids call cringe radio?
That's what one kid called it.
Kids don't know nothing. Kids don't listen to long form podcasts. They listen to the ticks and the talks.
The ticks and the talks.
Your kids are listening to something we don't even know about.
Hula boo!
I think I'm better.
Hula boo!
See, it works.
Yeah,
man.
I got to go more from the diaphragm.
And what other characters are there?
You didn't even get to the baby Picard. Remember what? You know, the number one dad.
He's my number one dad.
All right, you just.
Hula boo!
You just bought us a lot of goodwill.
Yeah.
With
sweet.
That one there. Yeah. Excellent. Okay.
The meter was running low.
We'll take a quick break. And then we will be right back.
Jim.
All right, we're back. Okay.
Deep emotional problems.
Yeah, that was a lot of stuff happened on that break. It's funny because people at home, they don't know.
They don't even know what happened.
They don't know how long, how much time has passed.
What happens on the break stays. Yeah,
how many days have passed.
Bleeds over.
Notice and augment.
There could be freeze. A big change in the energy from one break to the next.
Repeat and augment. Repeat.
CSI style.
That was actually, that reminded me of like Blade Runner.
It was similar to Blade
Runner.
Less tedious. I love Blade Runner. Blade Runner. Blade Runner's made a couple years before this movie, and it's a way more tedious augment scanning
scene.
This is just augment. Okay, there it is.
Light recorder visual 28.77.
Okay, so.
Light recorder visual 28.76.
Go.
You're not going in there.
Visual.
It's so good. This is a great movie. I really enjoy this movie.
I love his computer.
I from the beginning.
And augment.
When they're showing the scene with Kirk and Spock at the end of Star Trek II, and then it goes into the Kirk eulogizing
Enhance.
Spock, which I always cry at, especially when Kirk does the of all the souls in the world. Mm. And it's like, this was the most. This was the most.
Well,
I fucking start bawling. I bawl in Star Trek 2 at the end and at the beginning, right here at the fucking beginning, this depressing ass movie lays down the groundwork. It's like, this is not a happy movie. There's a mildly happy ending, but this
Nobody's
is not a happy,
happy
movie. A bunch of fucked up shit's about to happen, and we're going to start with some fucked up shit and make you feel all sad.
I don't know if this was just something crazy going on with my eyeballs, but it seemed like at the beginning when he does the good, I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad to hear that I'm doing all right. When he talks about he was the most human, that whole line, it starts bluish, and then it turns like into full color as he's finishing it. That was
an interesting cinematic technique. I think that this is an artistic movie, and in terms of Leonard Nimoy's direction.
Leonard Minoy's.
I think
Minoy's. What kind of a noise annoys Leonard Minoyster?
A Nimoy'sy noise?
A noise Minoy, a Leonard Minoyster.
Nimoy'sy noise?
I have composed myself.
Was I correct?
I have composed myself.
So this was the speech you're talking about.
Of all the souls I have encountered in my travels, his was the most human.
But so you think this is like a super compliment, right?
It's meant to make fun of it because otherwise I will start crying.
Yeah, no, understood.
On the podcast.
Understood.
And every time I start crying on the podcast, it's bad news.
Sad.
Yeah.
I love this. Star Trek is so important. I mean, it is. I'm mocking things because I don't want to. I'm so empathetic. I'm going to cry.
So here is a juxtaposition. Not even. I don't know if it was meant to be. But so he is talking about like Spock was the most human. This is a super compliment. It's all great.
Or
Spock,
it's a super insult.
Well, this is later on from Savick.
This is where the fun begins, Savick.
Just like your father. So human.
So human.
So she's like saying the same thing, except yeah. Like, you know, she's disarmed. And then there was a...
Vulcans are always using human as an insult because they're racist.
Right, but
Kirk is being a little... you could argue he's being a little smell. Racist.
He was using human as a compliment because he's, yeah. You know... But then there was another one, this is which is the classic...
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. The one.
And then at the end,
sorry again, it's a really good scene.
I know,
they're such good actors.
And then at the end,
because the needs of the one,
yeah,
outweighed the needs of the many.
So both of those are two reverso lines.
And that end bit. I know it's a little premature here, but that is another feather in the cap.
Feather
in the cap of this movie because
repeat,
it is a very
there's a feather in your cap
human idea. I think mm-hmm. It's fair to say. Up to this point, now, if you're listening to this podcast in the future, and if we have at some point in the future next week,
in the future,
years from now,
robots drive cars for us,
and if
they get in your car and they drive them around with their robot hands,
if we have encountered aliens
and
it
they
turns
get out,
out
and lock you in,
turns yeah. out they're very similar to us or whatever, then I will gladly retract any statements I'm making now. But I do like the idea, the philosophical idea. It's heavy. It's not just a reverse. Well, it's a heavy idea. The concept of the good of the one outweighs the good of the many.
Mm-hmm.
When does that apply?
Right.
What are the criteria? What does that mean?
When it's Spock and Kirk,
it retroactively explains. It really explains the whole movie. Not that the movie needs it in terms of motivation of the characters, but it's so pithily. Encapsulates the whole message of the movie. All these people.
Pithy sounds like such like a nasty word. Like you're insulting it by calling it pithy, but that's totally
no
not
pithy.
What
yeah, it's great.
I know it's a great word. I'm saying the way it sounds.
It's
the
like
way,
the part of the asparagus you can't eat. Like
yeah,
the
it's the pithy it's part. The pithy part. Yeah. Exactly. I think Jesse put it in the better words than I could have ever expressed.
It was pithily expressed.
Yeah. No, but I know pithy is a good word. It just to me yeah. It always sounds like a mean
but
word.
But the idea that these folks, all these people, are willing to sacrifice their careers, potentially their lives, potentially their freedom, in order to have a chance at helping, not even saving Spock's life, because that's not on the fucking table until way late in the movie, and certainly not in terms of what Kirk and co think that they're doing. It's just the outside chance that Spock's brain or like his soul can be
Katra.
Saved. His the equivalent, you know, whether you call it the soul or the digital download of
digital download
digital download. And that to me is another profound thing.
Who calls it that?
About this movie. Is that what all these that's what they're doing? They're not going to save a friend from prison. They're not going to save a friend's life.
They're doing some Vulcan mystical funerary.
Exactly. At the most base level, they are we just want to comply with our friend's cultural wishes.
Right.
And that is an odd message for 1984. You know,
Vulcan mysticism.
Yes, and. It's a subtle message because I'm sure many people watching the movie were not like wasn't jumping out of them, but that's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They're saying our friend comes from a culture he felt very strongly about this culture, and living up to its ideals.
He was always playing that funny instrument. and giving us shit about our stinky human ways.
So let's fucking go to prison for his dead ass.
Well, yeah, and Kirk was so.
So we're gonna steal a ship.
Kirk was so
blow it up.
Kirk was so casual about it too. He goes, "Gentlemen, your work today has been outstanding. I intend to recommend you all for promotion in whatever fleet we end up serving." He's so nonchalant. Is that because he knows they're not going to actually do anything to him, or is it because he doesn't give a fuck?
It's because he does. I would argue the latter, and I think a character trait of Kirk
that because they there was no follow up to any of the shenanigans that happened in this.
Well, it happens in Star Trek IV.
Yeah.
At the end of Star Trek IV, they go on trial for all this shit that goes down.
Yeah.
They just get bumped down a rank.
I guess you're right.
But
and he likes being bumped down a rank.
He does in the end. His first best destiny is captaining a starship. But the character of Kirk is consistent. You're making what kind of strange bear growling noise is Jesse making?
I don't know.
Maybe I kind of like him.
I don't know, man.
I don't know if they're. I just want to know, are they like pleasant sounds? Is he happy? Do you need some?
It was like kind of like when a dog's happy. It like sounds like sometimes it sounds weird. It's all like.
He was the most human. The most human. But Shatner's Kirk was consistent in
as opposed
his stoicism
to that other guy's Kirk.
Chris Pine.
Pine's Kirk. I kept wanting to say Pike's Kirk. But there's no such thing as Pike's Kirk.
Well, there is Pike's Kirk on Star Strange New Worlds, and I'm Paul Wesley. I'm not a big fan thus far
it's not,
of the portrayal, but we haven't seen...
It's not
haven't...
really Pike's Kirk. That would be a Strange New Worlds Kirk. It wouldn't be specifically
Pike. I know.
But that's poetic license.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. There you go. The point I'm trying to make is...
That's neither here nor there.
Shatner's Kirk, for sure. He was often very stoic, but he was also very decisive. And one of the, I think, key characteristics of Kirk, most of the time, when he wasn't in some way dealing with something that was throwing him off his game, Kirk was decisive. When he makes a decision, mm-hmm. he's all in.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't matter who he's dealing with, Starfleet, Khan, whoever. He's made a decision, and we see that multiple times in this movie. Mm. The first time is when Kirk tries to get permission to go back to the Genesis planet from the fellow who runs
Starfleet.
He says, "I'm Commander Starfleet. I'm pretty sure I'm
Genesis. I want it.
I want it." What?
They can't do this on Nintendo.
Give me Genesis.
They can't do this on Nintendo.
I have the secret of Genesis.
Genesis Dutch. They can't do this on Nintendo.
Yes, Genesis.
Genesis Dutch.
Genesis.
They can't do this on Nintendo.
Genesis is planet forbidden.
Okay, Kirk decisive. Yes, when he first,
remember that game Altered Beast?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I do.
Wise from your grave.
That game was all gimmick.
Wise from your grave.
The gimmick caught. The gimmick pulled me in.
It's a terrible game.
You got it.
I played it endlessly.
It caught
me too. But okay.
All right. Anyway, back at the ranch. The first thing that Kirk does is he has this conversation with the commander of Starfleet, tries to get permission. As soon as he realizes they're not going to go for it, he totally plays it off. He's like, "Man,
I had to try. Okay. You know me. I just had to try. I'm just having fun. My name's Kirk, and I just had to try.
I don't ever break the rules."
And the commander's like, "Okay, cool. I'm glad we're all on the same page."
Never broken
like,
the rules
before. Yeah, Kirk's all like, "Fuck my friend. It's all good. I just had to try." And then he walks back, and they're straight up like, "What's the deal?" He's like, "Meh, we're going to do it."
What was that? What did he say?
He's like, meh.
He's like, "What's the word?" "The word is no." Meh. Which is all this, "What's the word?" and "the word is given." That's all like a...
No!
A recapitulation of what happened in Star Trek 2.
Recapitulation.
Yes. Go back and watch Star Trek 2, and there's a whole business like, "Is the word given, Admiral?"
Speaking of recapitulation.
What about defenestration?
I was going to decide. Have you ever.
Hey, everybody.
Speaking of big
tape
words.
Tape up your windows. Jesse's in town. Tape your window. Board up your windows. Jesse's coming around the neighborhood. He's going to defenestrate your ass.
I'll let you finish your point, though, Patrick.
I mean, it's more of a bit than a point, but I think it's mostly.
You're talking about a recapitulation.
Yes, I'm talking about a recapitulation. I was previously talking about a recapitulation.
Yeah, and then I was going to say, that reminded me of, there was alliteration, which is not the same as recapitulation, but they're both college words.
So. Okay, I was going to wonder how you connected those college. Two words. Oh, alliteration and recapitulation.
So
those are high school words.
So a Savick.
I don't know, they might be a...
Savick was alliterative.
Seventh grade.
Like, yeah, yeah. Savick was alliterative, and this was close to each other, and it was like within a minute of each other, like probably within 10, 20 seconds of each other. First she says this.
It's time for total truth between us. It's time for total truth between us.
I did notice that, yeah.
It's time for total truth between us.
And then like a few seconds later, she's all.
How many have paid the price for your impatience? How many have paid the price for your impatience?
Isn't that interesting?
Do you like it?
It is. That one didn't pop out at me, though.
It popped out at me.
Pop.
Do you like Robin Curtis in the role of Savick, replacing Kirstie Alley, who had, in the intervening time, rocketed to fame on the NBC show Cheers?
Mm-hmm.
So she was too cool for Star Trek? Is that what happened?
Maybe she just wasn't available. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
But what's your view?
About Kirstie Alley versus...
I'm not asking you to compare them to each other. I was saying, do you like Robin Curtis in the role? Because, I mean, I think it's worth discussing, if even only briefly.
Maybe they should have had, like, Ted Danson on this movie.
What, as Savick?
No, it was just as a Vulcan. Klingon.
Yeah, maybe.
Something.
You're just playing beaming sounds? What's going on?
I was beaming away since I didn't want to answer the question. Oh.
You not like Robin Curtis?
No, I did. I just don't have... I have such a strongly not... opinion, no opinion. I'm so strongly unopinionated on it. I don't know. I mean, what I don't feel as strongly as I did about April O'Neil in the TMNT one.
Bring
versus,
April O'Neil in on the scene.
Then the first one. What was her name? Oh, what was her name?
What are you talking about?
April O'Neil in the first TMNT movie.
Her name was April O'Neil.
No, the actor. Judith
Hoag.
Yeah, Judith Hoag. And then
should know that off the top of your head.
I know, I should. And now that you said it, I do.
We're getting old.
But then I didn't.
Her brains are melting.
I liked her.
Judith Hoag is still deep, deep inside my brain, though.
So I was to say, I felt very strongly about how I preferred Judith Hoag to the next April, which was, I think, Paige Turco, who's nothing wrong with Paige Turco. April O'Neil was. Maybe it's just because she was the first one in the movie. So
Judith Hoag. Judith Hoag. Is fantastic.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, I think in order...
I don't want to make you uncomfortable. It's okay to not have an opinion.
No, here's the deal. I think in order to have a strong...
I'm not going
to
accuse you of sort of making... Just blending all women together into one monolithic sort of female caricature. I'm not going to accuse you of that.
All is well.
All I was going to say is that I would have to have had a strong emotion about the first Savick to care if they changed the actor about the second Savick. And to me, I don't know. Maybe it was just like my childhood wasn't as enraptured in Star Trek 2 the same way yours was or something.
Maybe not. Well, actually,
I love Star Trek and I love Star Trek 2 and 3. It's just, I don't think that like.
There's never much to say.
I didn't watch him over and over again. And yeah, the Savick is just kind of there. I don't know.
The reason I ask is because it comes up a lot. People discuss these things.
Which people?
The people out in the wild. You know, the people. These people who listen to our show. They're the types of people.
Have you lost all your sense of reality?
I bet lots of people have an opinion. Show. Lots of people listening to this program right now. Whether they're enjoying it or bawling their fists in fury and shaking it at their iPad players, iPods, or whatever the kids are using these days, telemophones.
I am trying to create an emotion for which Savick I like better, and I just can't.
Which is totally legitimate. I will present my position. My position is, on the one hand, it's neutral. I like them both, but they are different. And they're portrayed in different ways. Kirstie Alley was a bit more emotional is, I'm hesitant to use that word, but there's a little bit
more connection or something.
Yeah. She does the whole thing with like putting her hair down. Yeah. And she's also a cadet at that stage. It's a little confusing because not much time has passed, but now Savick seems like she's no longer a cadet. She seems more advanced in her career. Robin Curtis plays her very differently, much more a pure Vulcan, much more stoic.
So it's just your weak human tendencies that prefer the Kirstie Alley you're human.
First of all, I don't prefer the Kirstie Alley, and I tried to state outright at the beginning that I don't really have a preference between the two, but I do find the differences interesting because
weren't paying attention.
They lead to different characterizations. I think if you had Kirstie Alley in this movie, the scene with Savick and Spock doing the whole Ponfar rubbing fingers, imply. Do you think they had sex?
Well, it was suggested.
Because they do the whole like rubbing fingers and then it fades to black and then later everything's fine.
I mean, like, that's what you got to do with that guy, right?
As a kid, I interpreted that as, oh, as it happens, yeah, normally they got to have sex, but. She does some finger rubbing and it's all good.
She does some hand stuff.
Some sort of meditation. It helps cool his burning jets. As an adult, I watched this movie. I'm like, no, that was foreplay.
Yeah.
They were framing it, presenting it as foreplay.
Vulcan foreplay.
I don't know. I'd really like to hear from folks in the audience what their thoughts are on whether or not, maybe we'll put out a poll or something when this comes out. Because I'm kind of curious about the whole what do you think, how is it framed, because it's all goobled up in my mind.
Well, Vulcans are all like logical about like, you know, sex and Ponfar and stuff like that. They're not all weird. They're not all like, you know, a Vulcan male gets both of them get
just
Ponfar.
The males
just the males, males. Okay, it's not like the Vulcan male gets Ponfar and then the Vulcan woman is like, oh man, I don't think of you that way, sorry bro, and make it all embarrassing. You know, it's not all embarrassing. It's like, it's not like the Vulcan is going through Ponfar and then makes a move on someone.
I mean, Spock was often embarrassed
because at the end when Spock is grown and like he's back to being Spock and he walks down the line of all the people, he gives her a funny look.
Because he was like, I boned that chick when I was a teenager.
Yeah,
because it is slightly problematic.
Just yesterday, when I was a teenager,
my point was trying to make was that when Vulcans have Ponfar, I think it's not like there's not a.
what about when they have Ponnir?
There's not like a.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I deserve everything that's coming to me in the afterlife, if such a thing exists.
Pon close.
When they're because the problem is, I tend to often take puns too far. Mm-hmm. Pun far.
Yes, I get it. That's... Yeah, that was pretty good.
No,
puns
was it?
Too far.
I'm sorry. I did interrupt the flow of your excellent. Analysis.
It was a pawn too far.
The flow of your excellent analysis.
See, the thing is I have the problem is that Dan has a tendency to interpret my statements as being insincere when they were 100% sincere.
It just sometimes comes off as a little like.
I apologize. That's how I'm programmed.
Okay. That's fair enough. That's unfair of me.
My programmers didn't program me properly.
Okay, it's my bad for judging you.
But anyway, so you're saying they definitely fucked.
Well, I say there's probably not as much stigma like when a young Vulcan male like goes to Ponfar. Right. It's not like he's going crazy and hits on the Vulcan female and then she's all like, ooh,
it's
weird.
Like, it's like he's going crazy. I have to do something about it.
Yeah. For humans, for at least.
It's over.
Depending on what culture you're from, at least in our culture, a lot of times it's like it's sort of like. Not looked down upon, but it's stigmatized to have like these sexual feelings towards someone, or with them, it's just like it's got to happen.
He's tearing
this way.
The planet apart anyway, so it's only logical that she's got to, you know.
So
cool as
they're
jet.
Just saying, but like sex doesn't mean love, I guess, when you're Vulcan. Yeah,
I think that's all correct. I do think the one minor caveat there is that. On TOS, when Spock gets Ponfar, he's sort of embarrassed about it. Mm. That's probably a function of him, A, being half human, and B, being in the context of like a professional environment where these people don't know about this secret Vulcan thing that Vulcans are always hiding from people. And by the nature of the fact that they tend to hide this from people, it sort of makes you think that they do have some sort of collective embarrassment, at least outside of their culture.
When he blushes, he turns green.
But presumably not so much within their culture. And they're both Vulcans, so that works here.
In A Bridge Too Far, what did it go over top of?
I don't know. Was it a
pond that was too far?
Okay.
A pond far.
Yeah, I can pontoon. Kinda, a pontoon.
A pond far. I can kind of.
Pond far.
Yeah. Like a bridge too far.
It's over a pond too far.
Yes.
Pond far.
A now,
pond?
Is it,
it's under
now,
far
now,
pond.
Now, Jesse, you might know this. Is the term a bridge too far, is that a military term, like when you make a strategic error?
I think it's
of
just
going
the name
too,
of the movie.
Going,
the,
well, going too yeah, far, extending I mean, the lines too far. You don't
yeah,
know?
I don't, okay. I don't really know.
No, absolutely not.
All right. Well, how about this? I suggest
Let's
that we
look that one up.
We close out part one here, and then we we start on part start
Why
in earnest in part
this?
Two. So we will conclude our discussion of Star Trek III.
Be careful what you wish for.
The search for Spock with the Worms. And we have so much stuff to discuss in part two. We have the Enterprise, the destruction of the Enterprise. We've got McCoy going all goofy and all the McCoy goofiness stuff. We got Uhura in her limited but awesome role. And we've got a shitload more sound effects. We've got the Excelsior, which we haven't even mentioned. We've got Captain Esteban on the Grissom, which we haven't even mentioned. And all sorts of stuff. So when we come back next week, we will talk about all of this and more in part two of our discussion of Star Trek III, The Search for Spock.
You're suffering from a Vulcan mind meld, Doctor.
That green-blooded son of a bitch. It's his revenge for all those arguments he lost.